طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we feature a report back by Palestinian rights activist Nancy Murray, who recently returned from a fact-finding delegation to the West Bank. Nancy has been to Palestine over 20 times, often leading delegations, and we have come to depend on her reporting and analysis of the facts on the ground. We recently sat down with Nancy and recorded this report back and conversation.
So I recently returned from a 10-day trip with Eyewitness Palestine. I was leading a delegation, co-leading, I should say, a delegation to the West Bank and part of Israel. One of our delegates did not get in. That person, it was clearly profiling. She had a hijab, and she was asked, what Muslim organizations do you belong to? And after several hours, she was put on the plane and sent home. And I think that really is a little picture of what Israel is like today. It is basically completely acting with impunity. It knows that no Western country is going to say anything serious about what it's doing in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. All eyes are focused on Ukraine right now. So Israel can carry on with its business. And its business, I've been seeing this since 1988 when I paid my first trip, but it's now in stark relief. Its business is de facto annexation and eventually, probably, actual annexation of Area C of the West Bank. Area C is 62% of the West Bank. And I had last been there in 2018, and, you know, this was clearly happening. There were clearly plans to crisscross the West Bank with new bypass roads. Settlements were being expanded across the West Bank. And signs had been introduced, big red signs. And I'll just read what is on the signs. It's signs say, this road leads to Area A under the Palestinian Authority. The entrance for Israeli citizens is forbidden, dangerous to your lives, and is against the Israeli law. So I should explain that Area A are those territories, and there are not many of them now. It's less than 20% controlled by the Palestinian Authority. And that is going to be, if Israel gets its way, Palestine, 18%, 20%. What they are trying to do is terrify Israelis of Palestinians, who they have basically said are all terrorists, you know, they're born terrorists, and nobody should venture into these areas. Now that was, you know, I saw the red signs probably for the first time around 2013 during a trip. Now they have proliferated everywhere. And the picture you get now with the expanding bypass roads, with expanding settlements, with these signs everywhere, with the wall, is of, you know, it's not just apartheid, which it is, of course. It's a much cruder form of apartheid than existed in South Africa. I visited there as well, and I didn't see anything like this in South Africa, where every tiny little patch of Palestinian land was surrounded by checkpoints and barbed wire and the wall and surveillance and, you know, all sorts of cameras everywhere. And in the Gaza Strip, of course, drones, you know, just flying constantly overhead. So this is intense apartheid, but what's also going on is intense settler colonization, because they are taking the land now. It's a government controlled by settlers. It's a high court which seems to be controlled by settlers. It was a high court judge who made the ruling that 8 villages in the area south of Hebron, known as Masafer Yatta, should be destroyed to make way for a firing range, and over 1,000 Palestinians should be expelled from their homes. You know, settlers are now, they have their hands on levers of power, and they are calling the shots, and they are not going to be deterred. You know, I've been following their attacks on villagers when they go out to harvest their olive trees and so on. You know, they do this with the army standing by. The army never intervenes. And they're now doing what they do, whether it's graffiti on Palestinian villages, slashing the tires of Palestinian cars, stoning Palestinian cars, and taking over Palestinian land, erecting these so-called outposts, which are illegal even in Israel's eyes. All settlements, by the way, are illegal under international law. But these outposts are generally, you know, some sort of a crate or a tent or something which just gets the settlement movement moving. Because within months, possibly years, where they put their caravans or tents, that will become a new settlement. That has been the pattern. So, you know, we didn't get to the very north of the West Bank. We did get to the north of the Jordan Valley. But we went all around the area around Bethlehem, which is really being taken over, bypass roads everywhere. These beautiful Palestinian villages are now loomed over by settlements, and they're, in many cases, their land has all been taken. And some of them are in the process of themselves being destroyed. In one case, the case of Wadi Fokin, it's a 3,000-year-old village, and it's going to be destroyed. It has a settlement of 60,000 sort of towering over it, and now they're going to build a large highway, which will just take the rest of the land between the village and the settlement and, you know, basically make it impossible to live there. So this is the pattern. Settlers are on steroids. Nothing is stopping them. Certainly not you know, anything coming out of our ambassador's mouth or our State Department. They seem to be ignoring the situation. So settlements expanding. When we went all the way down through from Hebron, where more and more settlers are moving into the old city area and making life impossible for the Palestinians who live there. I mean, it's now a complete ghost town, the part of the old city near the Ibrahim Mosque. It was turned into the beginnings of a ghost town when a guy from Brooklyn, Baruch Goldstein, took a gun in 1994 and shot during Ramadan, shot and killed 29 Muslims who were praying in the Ibrahim Mosque and wounded hundreds. And instead of using that as the moment to say, hey, wait, we have to do something about this level of settler violence, Israel basically said, okay, we have to put the Palestinians under curfew, allow the Israeli settlers to basically take over the old city and divide what was the mosque into two. And that's the situation today, with more settlers coming all the time. While we were there, we did see Baruch Mazel, I think is his name. I think it's Baruch Mazel, who is the leading Kahanist. I don't know if people will remember Meir Kahane, who was an American terrorist, the Jewish Defense League. They were responsible for a lot of deaths in the United States. And this Kahanist movement is alive and well within Israel. Not only is this guy Mazel striding around the streets of Hebron with his, you know, full armaments over his shoulders, but also going back to Jerusalem in Sheikh Jarrah, which I'm sure people remember from last year, when it was the epicenter of the exchange of gunfire and violence that basically precipitated the, what was called the Unity Intifada in May of last year. Sheikh Jarrah is still being taken over, and this guy, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who is a Kahanist member of the Knesset, still has a so-called office. It's actually a little tent and a table and chair. But he's positioned it outside the next house in Sheikh Jarrah to be taken over. And we were, we talked to the family from that house, the Salem family, who've lived in Sheikh Jarrah since 1952. It's the house where the whole family, five sisters, three brothers were born. And they have been fighting to stay in the house ever since 1980s because settlers at that time claimed they had bought the house from its rightful owner, whoever that was, that there have never been shown any kind of document of sale and have no idea who the alleged owner is. For the last two decades, they have been in court. They paid something like $10,000 in court fees. They've been in court fighting to stay in their home. And earlier this year, settlers and soldiers attacked them. The elderly mother, the matriarch, was sprayed with pepper spray and beaten by settlers who fenced off part of their land. I don't know if people read about this at the time, but it was one of the flashpoints in Sheikh Jarrah. And now we have got a situation where I think just about now the family will hear from the last possible committee about whether they're going to be expelled from their home. It's been in court, it's gone to this rigmarole, that rigmarole, and now they're going to get a decision. And we heard about the situation from both the family, but also from an amazing activist, I'd never met him before, his name is Muhammad Abu al-Humas, who set up his own tent next to the tent of the Kahanist Gvir. And for 2 months, he's been living there. His tent has been torn down 11 times by settlers. He's been beaten up. I mean, he's, you know, had a terrible time, but he is determined not to give up. And the community keeps replacing his tent. So there he is. He came to see us with his arm in plaster, and he was limping badly because he had been in the demonstrations to save Al-Aqsa during this Ramadan. I don't know if people remember that there were attempted invasions of Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan, and it got very violent. At one time, soldiers charged into the mosque. Anyway, he was there, and he, like so many, was beaten and wounded. This was when they were actually using drones to tear gas people in the mosque while they were praying. So Sheikh Jarrah is there, and so are six Israeli consulates, six foreign consulates, include and the headquarters of the quartet. That's the U.S., Russia, the EU, and UN, which is supposed to manage the peace process. They're all based there, but they do nothing. They say nothing. They watch. And everyone who spoke to us in Sheikh Jarrah said the only thing that can stop this is foreign pressure. Otherwise, the whole community is going to be evicted, because this is really now ethnic cleansing, full tilt ethnic cleansing. And we saw it not only in Sheikh Jarrah, but in other parts of the old city of Jerusalem, where more and more of the old houses are being taken over. We saw it, of course, in Massacre Yatta, where, you know, everyone's being kicked out. We saw it as we went further south. We saw it within 48 Israel, happening to people who are Israeli citizens, namely the Bedouin, the Palestinian citizens of Israel who live in the Negev and are suffering the same kind of ethnic cleansing to clear the land, to Judaize the land, to put it totally in the hands of Jewish farmers and make the Bedouin who've lived there, you know, for time immemorial, to shove them off into some kind of development town where they won't get any more services or anything. I had never done this before, visited some of the unrecognized villages. Now, these are villages inside Israel, Bedouin villages that have nothing. They have no water, no electricity, no roads, no waste disposal. They're not on any map, no schools, no clinics. There are, I think, now 37 of them. They have, over the years, groups like Adala, which is an Israeli legal group, have gone to court, and they've managed to get some of them recognized. But even so, we went to one of the ones that was recognized, and even it didn't have much. But, you know, at least it's on the map, which means it might not be destroyed. We didn't get this time to a place I had visited twice before in the desert called Al-Araqib, which was being destroyed at the time. Last time I went, over 100 times. Now it's over 203 times. And the people keep coming back. But the JNF, Jewish National Fund, has planted these trees. And when I first saw them, they were small, little, tiny eucalyptus trees. Now they're quite big. They're going to be a forest. And that is how they're getting people off the land. When Al-Araqib and these other villages were denied water over the years, these trees, which are very water-greedy trees, are slurping up the water, massive irrigation to make the forests grow, to get rid of Bedouin, who are citizens of Israel. So I think the whole picture is that step by step, what Israel has been doing for so many years, demolishing a house here, kicking out a family there, not allowing a family, you know, to reunite across the green line, or saying that a family has no right to live in Jerusalem because it's not the center of their life. They've lived there all their lives, but when at a certain day they didn't happen to be present, so they're expelled from their home. All of this is now adding up into a picture of really clearing the land of people who have lived there for years and taking over their property. And I just want to add one sort of description of a place which will show you how you can do massive ethnic cleansing, but in a very clever way. So there is the need of Jerusalem residents need to stay in Jerusalem. If they live for, say, a week in the West Bank, they can be denied their residency. And, you know, you might think, well, what is so special about residency in Jerusalem? You know, doesn't do much. But you do have a little more freedom of movement. Most people in the West Bank cannot get to Jerusalem. You have a different colored license plate, and you can get through checkpoints in an easier way. So there are some advantages, but then there are a lot of disadvantages because you're under such pressure all the time to leave. And one of the things that's happened, you know, there have been all these house demolitions in parts of Jerusalem, not just Sheikh Jarrah, but Sinwan and other areas, which are undergoing Judaization to make way for things like a biblical theme park and, you know, houses for Jewish families, kick out Arabs. Here is one terrible vision I have of the future of Jerusalem. We went north from Jerusalem. The border has been extended very far. This is all now the municipality of Jerusalem. And you go up towards Calandia checkpoint, which is this horrific looking thing. And right up there, there's a part, it's still called East Jerusalem, but it's called Kfar Aqab. And it's grown so huge. I saw it a few, maybe in 2015. It's now these towering, precarious looking tower blocks crammed together. They're behind the apartheid wall, which is Calandia, and they border the city of Ramallah, which is in the West Bank. So first time I saw it, I didn't understand it, because Ramallah does not look like that. And suddenly you get to this area, which is these just gigantic, they look like they could topple over at any point, and they didn't have what looked like paved roads and so on. Now, this is the home for 80,000, currently, Palestinians who hold Jerusalem residency, but they cannot find housing in the real East Jerusalem, where their building permits are routinely denied. There's no way to stay there to build a house and not have your house destroyed. So this is where they go, because it's still called Jerusalem, and they can live there and still keep their Jerusalem IDs. So they move into this area, which is really a no man's land. It has no services. It's a bit like the villages in the Negev. It has no fire department. It has no police force. And when you're there, if you have a fire, there's no point calling the municipality of East Jerusalem to send a fire truck, because they won't go through the wall. You can't call Ramallah, because they're not allowed out of the West Bank into East Jerusalem with their fire truck. So there you are, you know, unless you have your own sort of hoses and so on, the building will burn down. Likewise, we heard if someone is killed in a fight, and it's very tightly packed, and I think there's now quite a bit of violence, the East Jerusalem police can't intervene. If you call them 911, they'll say, oh, just take the body and leave it at Calandia checkpoint. Now, 80,000 people, imagine this, and they are all expecting and terrified that at some stage Israel will just say with a flick of a pen, this is now the West Bank. You no longer have East, you know, Jerusalem ID. And that's how they will be able to deal with what concerns them so much about East Jerusalem, namely the demographic demographic balance. They just do not want, you know, a certain percentage of Palestinians there they can swallow, but they don't want numbers to rise. So they can, you know, with a flick of a pen, get rid of 80,000 Jerusalemites. Now, this hasn't happened yet, but everyone feels they are living on borrowed time, and they will simply be disappeared from the city of Jerusalem. Now, it was incredibly depressing to see all this, and I don't want to leave this as my whole message, because there was also such amazingly courageous resistance going on. Whether it's cultural or resistance in terms of showing a real determination not to be forced off the land. People there are still struggling. And this, our delegation was called the Land and Environment Delegation. So we spent a lot of time going, looking at the land, looking at what's happening, farming, looking at efforts to do some sort of sustainable farming on rooftops in the case of the Ida camp, which was just so inspiring. Going to the Jordan Valley, where what strikes you is so astonishing, is it's acres and acres and acres of greenhouses from settlement farms. And they have taken up, you know, most of the land that I could see as we drove along, and the water, the bulk of the water, and they're trying to get Palestinians off the land, the Palestinians, again, shepherds and people who are herders of various sorts and farmers, to make them leave, to make way for a completely cleansed Jordan Valley. So, you know, when you see how far they have gone in this effort, you would think people would just give up, but they're not. We went up to the north, to a village in the north of Jordan Valley, where there's the Jordan Valley Solidarity Campaign headquarters, and they're figuring out all sorts of ways to fight back. When their water pipes get destroyed by settlers, they go and they attack settler water pipes. You know, they are refusing to just, you know, roll over and, you know, say, we've had it. They're getting people from all different villages within the West Bank, and some from 48 are coming and helping, you know, really protect the farmers when they're out there on the land. I should say that just like in the case of Masafer Yatta, one of the ways of getting rid of people is to declare it a military zone or a firing zone. And that's what's been happening in both places, both in south of the Hebron Hills, in the South Hebron Hills, and in Jordan Valley. But, you know, people are resisting. The thing is, I don't know how long the resistance will be effective without intervention from the outside world. And what Israel is trying to make sure happens is that it can silence the situation. And that is why you have the six leading civil society and human rights groups being designated as quote-unquote terrorist organizations. We met with two of them. We met with Al-Haq, which is the oldest human rights organization in the Middle East, and we met with Adamir. And, you know, these are very widely respected groups that are now Israel is trying to silence. And the other way it is doing it is by trying to silence journalists. And I know that while I'm sure you've heard about the assassination of the very renowned in the region, the Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, she was killed the morning of our meeting with Sarah Francis of Adamir. She had been a close friend, and we got a sense of the scale of this tragedy just from the reaction of everyone we talked to. When we were driving down to Wadi Fokin, we left our hotel in Jerusalem and we went by St. Joseph's Hospital where her body was. And they were going to take it from there to the Catholic Church in the Old City for the funeral service. And we saw the army gathering. We didn't know what it was going to do, but the signs were there that something terrible was going to happen. And we had our meeting in Wadi Fokin, and we were joined after a few hours by a young man who was the son of the family meeting with us, who had had his arm bashed up. He had been in the procession taking her body and then, you know, being attacked viciously. And I'm sure you've seen that. Many of you have seen the images of that. And he told us, you know, what it was like. And I think something probably most people don't know is that a few days later, Israel similarly attacked the funeral service of someone else who had been killed, also in Jenin, just like Shireen, where she was killed. And they did the same thing. They tried to grab the coffin, which to me says, you know, all the publicity, all of the images of Shireen's, you know, that desecration of her funeral doesn't bother them in the least. They'll do it again. And, you know, so the impunity is, it's just so huge now because they've been able to get away with so much. And unless we could find a way to really intervene, especially in the U.S., given the amount of aid we give them, you know, they're just not going to listen. So my message, the message I brought back from the people we heard from, was America has got to do something. And the message I want to say to everyone here is that we've all got to speak out. We've really got to say enough. This is a horrendous apartheid situation. It's a situation of ethnic cleansing, settler colonialism. It's happening in the 21st century. These things were supposed to be behind us. We have all this international law, which is being made a mockery of by Israel's behavior, and this has got to change. You know, we had such wonderful lunches because we had them with families, and everywhere people were so welcoming and, as ever, incredibly hospitable and, as ever, incredibly good cooks. And so one of the places where we had such a lunch was in the home of Bassem Tamimi, the Tamimi household, in Nabi Saleh. And I'm sure people have heard of their daughter, Ahed Tamimi. I just bring you the news of Ahed. She was denied a visa to do university in England. She was denied a visa to do university in the U.S. So she's now at Berzeit University. And she has a book coming out. In December, Random House is bringing out her book, They Call Me a Lioness. So everyone should look out for that. The Tamimis, I mean, there they are, utterly steadfast, but very tired, very, very tired looking. And they don't do the weekly protests anymore. I mean, they became so, there was so much violence. So many people got injured and killed. So they don't do that. There are places we didn't get to in the north of the West Bank where they have taken up these weekly protests and they get attacked utterly viciously. But they're going on. That kind of resistance is continuing. But Nabi Saleh is taking a break. You know, they're you know, not going to give up by any means, but they're trying to think of other ways to be, you know, effective. I want to go back to Wadi Fokin because I am from a group called the Alliance for Water Justice in Palestine, and we had been following this village's ordeal for some time because what happens there is you've got this giant settlement of 60,000 people, Betar elite, throwing its sewage down the hill. You could see the path where it comes down onto village land. This village was the breadbasket of Jerusalem. It was the breadbasket for all the villages around. Now, of course, farmers can't get into Jerusalem, which is just a few miles away, to sell their products. But even so, who would buy them? Because now the land, they have the reputation of being, you know, grown in settlership. You know, the land has been so polluted by what comes off the hills. They had 11 springs at one point, which is why they were the breadbasket. I mean, it was this incredible, fertile area. The settlers, just building the settlement has caused most of, well, I think five of the springs to dry up. The other springs are visited every Friday by settlers who come. They call them, it's holy water to them. They take off their clothes and they splash around in these village springs. And this is, you know, total lack of respect of their neighbors. They also come down and they write the graffiti, death to Arabs, all that kind of stuff in the village. So, you know, this is somehow people live in these pressure cooker situations with neighbors who don't consider them fully human. Another place we had this, we could see this clearly, was in Tent of Nations. And I think a lot of people have visited Tent of Nations because they've made it a point to open their caves. They have a whole series of caves. They can't have buildings because they have no permits. This is Area C. So they have wonderful caves, and they invite people to come and to learn about their struggle. Their struggle to hold on to land, which not only have they been living on for, you know, 100 years, but they have documents too, which is not always the case for Palestinian farmers, because the Ottomans didn't always, you know, under Ottoman law before the British Mandate, you didn't always get documents, but they have it. They have them saying this is their land, and even so, I think it's for 22 years, they have been going to court to fight to keep their land. These settlements ring the Tent of Nations. At night, you could just, you know, see the lights. We actually stayed, when I said they don't have houses, they do have a, for the time being, a kind of, what are those things called? Where you store food, a big metal container, which we slept in. Very big. I mean, it was. So we all spent the night there, and we slept in this container, kind of tent container. And in the night, this helicopter, we thought it was going to land on us. I mean, it just shook the whole thing to its, you know, just everything was vibrating. And we figured the next day that it must have been because of the procession of the body of Shireen, because it, you know, that body, her body was carried through various parts of the West Bank, and it must have been going to do something to the people, because it was clearly a military, you know, on a military mission. And I want to say that you hear, of course, every Israeli who is killed, you hear about, but Palestinians are getting killed steadily. So there is a constant taking out of Palestine, killing them. Ever since in March, I think it was March, and I can find the exact date, after there were some killings of Israelis inside Israel, the Israeli government said to the soldiers, you know, the gloves are off. There is no limit to what you can do. And since then, there has been this steady shooting down of kids, I mean, you know, 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds, and with the one target area is the Jenin camp. One of the people they accused of killing an Israeli had been a 9-year-old when the Jenin camp in 2002 was destroyed by Israeli tanks, bulldozers. They came in, they killed over 50 people, and they leveled part of the camp. And, you know, that was what he saw, what he witnessed when he was a kid. And his whole life now, since from that time forth, has been in these terrible conditions of lack of freedom and lockdown. And he allegedly took a gun or a knife, I'm not sure which, and is the person they have identified as killing one of the people inside Israel. So, you know, this situation, it's totally unsustainable. It's unsustainable because it is warping the state of Israel. I mean, to have people just feel that they can do anything at all to their neighbors, to Palestinians, just because they're not Jewish. I mean, that is, you know, inhumane, to say the least of it. So I hate to think what these young Israelis who go do their military service inside the West Bank, how that conditions them. It's very frightening. And, you know, it even gets worse when you think of what's going on in Gaza, because there in Gaza, you have a lockdown for 15 years of people not having clean water to drink. You have the Israel, you know, smashing the whole infrastructure. It calls it mowing the lawn, and then not allowing in the material and equipment to fix that infrastructure, including, you know, we're talking about a power station, we're talking about wastewater treatment plants and so on. I mean, it's a terrible, unsustainable, inhumane situation. And these things cannot be allowed to last. I mean, it just has got to be stopped.
What, Nancy, why don't we hear about this in the American media? I mean, this picture you paint is certainly not the one that we get here. And so, for the most part, we're not hearing it.
Right. Now, that is a huge problem. I must say, the New York Times, over the last 2 years, has improved a little bit. But, you know, one story won't really make the difference. So you get one story by Patrick Kingsley, and now they have a writer, Rula, can't remember her last name, but they are doing better. You know, I noticed the New York Times in last May did an amazing thing for the New York Times. It featured on its front page pictures of the 62 Palestinian children, naming them, who had been killed in Israel's bombing of the Gaza Strip, and giving a little story about that. That would have never happened before. So things are, you know, starting to shift, but then they don't follow up. Take the six groups that have been called terrorist organizations. You know, they don't make a story out of that, but it should be a huge story because it's part of Israel's shutting down all avenues of getting out the truth. By the way, did I mention that at least 48 journalists, Palestinian journalists, have been killed since the year 2000? Mm. You know, so this is not, killing Shireen is by no means unique, although it is given her stature and the fact that she's an American citizen. So there's no repetition. If you might get a glimpse of the truth of what's happening there, it then doesn't appear again. You know, they move on. And by the way, when Amnesty wrote its report, that didn't even get mentioned in the New York Times. The Amnesty report.
Still hasn't, yeah. And when you compare how the coverage of what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening to the cities and to the land in Ukraine, with what's been going on in Palestine for over 70 years, you see the kind of, you know, stark reality of how the United States really condones what's happening in Palestine and covers up and funds the
Well, Ukraine was very much on people's minds, and they all said, of course, you know, the occupation of Ukraine must be condemned. But what about us?
Yeah.
We're here too.
Right.
We have this military occupation, right, which right. is, you know, yeah. destroying our lives and livelihoods. But, yeah, I mean, the double standards of the U.S., you know, to say it's a fair arbiter, a sort of, whatever.
Oh, come on, yeah.
Even-handed. Yeah, it's just not the case.
Yeah, yeah.
And people there recognize that. They do recognize that there is a change in American public opinion. They've heard about young, you know, Jews increasingly being against what Israel's doing. And I just want to bring up one rather remarkable fact, which I don't know if people know it, but there was a survey done by the University of Maryland on April 20, and it showed that only a tiny fraction of Democratic Party voters, less than 1%, regard Israel as one of the top two U.S. allies. Most placed Israel behind the U.K., Canada, Germany, Mexico, France, Japan, South Korea, and get this, China. So somehow the notion that this is our, you know, incredible right-hand friend, you know, stand with us, you know, through thick and thin, etc., has not penetrated the Democratic Party voters. 20% of the Republicans rank Israel as number one friend. So that's interesting. And in another University of Maryland poll, 60% of academics in the field of Middle East studies describe the current reality in Israel-Palestine as, quote, a one-state reality akin to apartheid. So the word, you know, has gotten to somebody, but, you know, it doesn't change policy. And we now see with AIPAC, you know, having its own PAC to, you know, fund candidates openly. I mean, it's always done it covertly, but now to do it openly. You know, we see one good reason why. I don't think it's the only reason, but one good reason why policy isn't changing.
Hmm. That's right.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing about Israel is its military might now. I mean, it's now become a major exporter of armaments, and especially its ability to surveil the population.
Yeah.
It's pretty frightening. You know, how they have something on every Palestinian. I mean, they, you know, because you can't get through a checkpoint without having, you know, all of the scans and body, you know, it's all there in their databases. And that's another level of this lack of freedom. You know, you don't have freedom to move, you don't have freedom to think, and you don't have freedom to really just sort of say anything over the phone, because Pegasus and NSO, you know, could be listening and all of that. They're asphyxiating the society is what they're doing.
Yeah. And we fund it.
We fund it, you know, now, before we gave them the extra $1 billion for the dome, for the Iron Dome, the Massachusetts taxpayers were paying $170 million a year, just Massachusetts, to fund Israel. I haven't done the calculation with the extra $1 billion added, but that's $170 billion of Massachusetts residents' taxes. I'm sure most Massachusetts residents have not a clue.
No.
What's happening.
No one's telling them. No. No one's telling the story.
No. However, you know, social media, for all of its great flaws, is getting, you know, images out.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's shutting down Palestinian voices, and it's doing all sorts of other awful things.
Mm.
But it has been more of a way to peer into what's happening over there.
Right. Wonderful. Well, we've run out of time. Thanks so much for telling us your story about this trip. I know you've been over countless times. How many? Over 20, right?
I think, yeah, over 20. I stopped counting, you know, actual numbers, but something like that. And to the Gaza Strip. And I'm very sorry my last trip to Gaza was in 2016, and it's so difficult to get in.
That's the understatement of the year.
Yeah. But I do want to recommend to everybody Eyewitness Palestine as a group, which does, you know, wonderful, puts together wonderful delegations. And with the urging people who go that they have to do something when they come back.
Yeah.
This is not just, you know, tourism. This has got to be more meaningful than that. And so the people who go with that in mind, that they're going to come back and get active. And we just need so many more of them. We need everyone to be active to be able to really change the way things are.
Yeah. Thank you, Nancy.
Okay. Thanks, John.
Okay.
You have been listening to a report back by Palestinian rights activist Nancy Murray, who recently returned from leading a delegation to the West Bank. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, where you can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. You can also stream us live on Sunday evenings at kkrn.org at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will add your voice to the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.